On the return journey, the Daimler was only just large enough to accommodate all of them, with Anna sitting on Sir Gary's lap and submerging him beneath her abundance. As Santaine drove down the twisting road through the forest of tall blue gum trees, Shasta leaned over the seat from behind her and encouraged her to greater speed. "Come on, Mater, you've still got the handbrake on." Sitting beside Santaine, the general clutched his hat and stared fixedly at the speedometer. "That can't be right," he said. "It feels more like 100 miles an hour. Santaine swung the Daimler between the elaborately gabled white main gates of the estate. The pediment above, depicting a party of dancing nymphs bearing bunches of grapes, had been designed by the famous sculptor Anton Anreith. The name of the estate was blazoned in raised letters above the sculpture. Welterweiden, 1790. "Well satisfied" was the translation from the Dutch, and Santaine had purchased it from the illustrious Kluyt family exactly 1 year after she had pegged the claims to the Harney mine. Since then she had lavished money and care and love upon it. She slowed the Daimler almost to walking pace. "I don't want dust blowing over the grapes," she explained to General Smuts, and her face reflected such deep content as she looked out on the neatly pruned rows of trellised vines that he thought how the estate had been aptly named. The coloured labourers straightened up from the vines and waved as they passed. Shasta leaned from the window and shouted the names of his favourites as they grinned with huge gratification at being singled out. The road, lined with mature oaks, led up through 200 acres of vines to the chateau. The lawns around the great house were bright green kikuyu grass. General Smuts had brought shoots of the grass back from his East African campaign in 1917, and it had flourished all over the country. In the centre of the lawn stood the tall tower of the slave bell, still used to toll the beginning and end of the day's labours. Beyond it rose the glacial white walls and massive Anreith gables of Welterweiden under its thatched roof. Already the house servants were hurrying out to fuss around them as they spilled out of the big yellow machine. "Lunch will be at 1:30, Santaine told them briskly. "Oh, Baas, I know Sir Gary wants to read his latest chapter to you. Cyril and I have a full morning's work ahead." She broke off. "Shasta, where do you think you're off to?" The boy had sidled to the end of the stoop and was within an ace of escaping. Now he turned back with a sigh. "Jock and I were going to work out the new pony." The new pony had been Cyril's Christmas present to Shasta. "Madame Claire will be waiting for you," Santaine pointed out. "We agreed that your mathematics needed attention, didn't we?" "Oh, Mater, it's holiday time. Every day you spend idly, there is someone out there working," said Santaine. "And when he meets you, he is going to whip you hollow." "Yes, Mater." Shasta had heard that prediction many times before, and he looked to his grandfather for support. "Oh, I'm sure your mother will allow you a few hours to yourself after your maths tuition," he came in dutifully. "As you pointed out, it is officially holiday time." He looked hopefully at Santaine. "Might I also enter a plea on my young client's behalf?" General Smuts backed him, and Santaine capitulated with a laugh. "You have such distinguished champions, but you will work with Madame Claire until 11's," she said. Shasta thrust his hands into his pockets and with slumped shoulders went to find his tutor. Anna disappeared into the house to chiver the servants, and Gary led General Smuts away to discuss his new manuscript. "All right," Santaine jerked her head at Cyril. "Let's get to work." He followed her through the double teak front doors, down the long voorkamer, her heels clicking on the black and white marble floors, to her study at the far end. Her male secretaries were waiting for her, Santaine could not abide the continual presence of other females. Her secretaries were both handsome young men. The study was filled with flowers. Every day the vases were refilled from the gardens of Veltevreden. Today it was blue hydrangeas and yellow roses. She seated herself at the long Louis XIV table she used as a desk. The legs were in richly ornate ormolu, and the top was expansive enough to hold the memorabilia she had assembled. There were a dozen photographs of Chasse's father in separate silver frames, covering his life from schoolboy to dashing young airman in the RFC. The last photograph depicted him with the other pilots of his squadron, standing in front of their single-seater scout planes. Hands thrust into his pockets, cap on the back of his head, Michael Courtney grinned at her, seemingly as certain of his immortality as he had been on the day that he died in the pyre of his burning aircraft. As she settled into her leather wing-backed chair, she touched the photograph, rearranging it slightly. The maid could never get it exactly right. "I've read through the contract," she told Cyril as he took the chair facing her. "There are just two clauses I am not happy with. The first is clause 26. He turned to it obediently, and with her secretaries standing attentively on each side of her chair, she began the day's work. Always it was the mine which occupied Santaine first. The Hahani mine was the source, the spring from which it all flowed, and as she worked, she felt her soul yearning towards the vastness of the Kalahari, towards those mystic blue hills and the secret valley which had concealed the treasures of the Hahani for countless eons before she had stumbled upon them, dressed in skins and a last tattered remnant of cloth, great with the child in her womb and living like an animal of the desert herself. The desert had captured part of her soul, and she felt joyous anticipation rising in her. Tomorrow, she thought. Tomorrow Chasse and I will be going back. The lush vineyards of the Constantia Valley and the Chateau of Veltevreden, filled with beautiful things, were part of her also. But when they cloyed, she had to go back to the desert and have her soul burned clean and bright once more by the white Kalahari sun. As she signed the last of the documents and handed them to her senior secretary for witnessing and sealing, she stood and crossed to the open French doors. Down in the paddock, beyond the old slave quarters, Chasse, released from his mathematics, was schooling his pony under Jock Murphy's critical eye. It was a big horse. The limitation on size had recently been dropped by the International Polo Association, but he moved well. Chasse turned him neatly at the end of the paddock and brought him back at a full gallop. Jock tossed a ball to his near side, and Chasse leaned out to take it on his back hand. He had a firm seat and a strong arm for one so young. He swung in a good full arc, and the crisp click of the bamboo root ball carried to where Santaine stood, and she saw the white flash of its trajectory in the sunlight. Chasse reined the pony down and swung him back. As he passed again, Jock Murphy tossed another ball to his off-side forehand. Chasse topped the shot, and it bounced away sloppily. "Shame on you, Master Chasse," Jock called. "You are chopping again. Let the head of your stick take your shot through." Jock Murphy was one of Santaine's finds. He was a stocky, muscular man with a short neck and a perfectly bald head. He had done everything. Royal Marines, professional boxer, opium runner, master-at-arms to an Indian Maharaja, racehorse trainer, bouncer in a Mayfair gambling club, and now he was Chasse's physical instructor. He was a champion shot with rifle, shotgun and pistol, a 10-goal polo player, deadly on the snooker table. He had killed a man in the ring, ridden in the Grand National, and he treated Chasse like his own son. Once in every 3 months or so, he went on the whiskey and turned into a devil incarnate. Then Santayne would send someone down to the police station to pay the damages and bail Jock out. He would stand in front of her desk, his derby hat held in front of his chest, shaky and hungover, his bald head shiny with shame, and apologize humbly. "It won't happen again, missus. I don't know what came over me. Give me another chance, missus. I won't let you down." It was useful to know a man's weakness, a leash to hold him, and a lever to move him. There was no work for them in Windhoek. When they arrived, having walked and begged lifts on trucks and wagons all the way from the coast, they moved into the hobo encampment near the railway tracks on the outskirts of the town. By tacit agreement, the 100 or so down-and-outers and drifters and out-of-workers were allowed to camp here with their families. But the local police kept a wary eye on them. The huts were of tar paper and old corrugated iron sheets and rough thatch, and in front of each squatted dejected clusters of men and women. Only the children, dusty and skinny and sun-browned, were noisy and almost defiantly rambunctious. The encampment smelled of wood smoke and the shallow pit latrines. Somebody had erected a crudely lettered sign facing the railway tracks. "Val Hearts, hell no." Anyone who applied for unemployment benefits was immediately sent by the government labour department to work on the huge Val Hearts river irrigation project for 2 shillings a day. Rumours of the conditions in the labour camps there had filtered back, and in the Transvaal there had been riots when the police had attempted forcibly to transport men to the scheme. All the better spots in the encampment were already occupied, so they camped under a small camel-thorn bush and hung scraps of tar paper in the branches for shade. Svart Hendrik was squatting beside the fire, slowly trickling handfuls of white maize meal into a soot-blackened billy of boiling water. He looked up as Lothar came back from another unsuccessful job hunt in the town. When Lothar shook his head, Hendrik returned to his cookery. "Where is Manfred?" asked Lothar. Hendrik pointed with his chin at another shack nearby. A dozen or so ragged men were sitting in a fascinated knot, listening to a small, bearded man in their midst. He had the intense expression and fanatically dark eyes of a zealot. "Malvillum," Hendrik muttered. "Crazy William." And Lothar grunted as he searched for Manfred and then recognized his son's shining blonde head amongst the others. Satisfied that the boy was safe, Lothar took his pipe from his top pocket, blew through it, and then filled it with Magaliesberg shag. The pipe stank, and the black tobacco was rank and harsh, but cheap. He longed for a cheroot as he lit the pipe with a twig from the fire. It tasted disgusting, but he felt the soothing effect almost immediately, and he tossed the tobacco pouch to Hendrik and leaned back against the trunk of the thorn tree. "What did you find out?" he asked. Hendrik had spent most of the night and morning in the coloured shantytown across the other side of Windhoek. If you want to know a man's intimate secrets, ask the servants who wait at his table and make his bed. "I found out that you can't get a drink on credit, and the Windhoek maids don't do it for love alone," he grinned. Lothar spat tobacco juice and glanced across at his son. It worried him a little that the boy avoided the camp urchins of his own age and sat with the men. Yet the men seemed to accept him. "What else?" he asked Hendrik. "The man is called Fury," Hendrik said. "He has been working at the mine for 10 years. He comes in with 4 or 5 trucks every week and goes back loaded with stores. For a minute, Hendrik concentrated on mixing the maize porridge, applying exactly the right heat from the fire. "Go on," said Lothar. "Then, on the first Monday of every month, he comes in one small truck, the 4 other drivers with him riding in the back, all of them armed with shotguns and pistols. They go directly to the Standard Bank in Main Street. The manager and his staff come to the side door. Fury and one of his drivers carry a small iron box from the truck into the bank. Afterwards, Fury and his men go down to the corner bar and drink until closing time. In the morning, they go back to the mine." "Once a month," Lothar whispered. "They bring in a whole month's production at one time." Then he looked up at Hendrik. "You said the corner bar?" And when the big black man nodded, "I'll need at least 10 shillings." "What for?" Hendrik was immediately suspicious. "One of us has to buy the barman a drink, and they don't serve blacks at the corner bar." Lothar smiled maliciously, then raised his voice. "Manfred!" The boy had been so mesmerized by the speaker that he had not noticed his father's return. He scrambled to his feet guiltily. Hendrik dumped a lump of fluffy white maize porridge into the lid of the billy and poured maas, thick soured milk, over it before he handed it to Manfred, where he squatted cross-legged beside his father. "Did you know that it's all a plot by the Jewish owners of the gold mines in Johannesburg, Papa?" Manfred asked, his eyes shining like a religious convert's. "What is?" Lothar grunted. "The Depression." Manfred used the word importantly, for he had just learned it. "It's been arranged by the Jews and the English so that they will have all the men they want to work for them, for nothing, on their mines and in their factories."
"Is that so?"
Lothar smiled as he spooned up the maas and maize meal. "And did the Jews and the English arrange the drought as well?" His hatred of the English did not extend beyond the borders of reason, though it could not have been more intense had the English indeed engineered the drought that had turned so many of his people's farms into sandy wastelands, the topsoil blown away on the wind, and the livestock into desiccated mummies embalmed in their own plank-hard skins. "It's so, Papa," Manfred cried. "Oom Willem explained it to us." He pulled a rolled sheet of newsprint from his back pocket and spread it across his knee. "Just look at this." The newspaper was De Vaterland, an Afrikaans language publication, The Fatherland. And the cartoon that Manfred was pointing out with a forefinger that trembled with indignation was its typical style. "Look what the Jews are doing to us!" The main character in the cartoon was Hoggenheimer, one of De Vaterland's creations, depicted as a gross creature in frock coat and spats, a huge diamond sparkling in his cravat, diamond rings on the fingers of both his hands, a top hat over his dark Semitic curls, a thick drooping lower lip, and a great hooked beak of a nose, the tip of which almost touched his chin. His pockets were stuffed with 5-pound notes, and he brandished a long whip as he drove a loaded wagon towards distant steel headgear towers labelled gold mines. In the traces of the wagon were human beings instead of Trek oxen. Lines of men and women, skeletal and starving, with huge, tortured eyes as they toiled onwards under Hoggenheimer's whip. The women wore the traditional Voortrekker bonnets and the men slouch hats, and so that there could be no mistake, the artist had labelled them Die Afrikaner Volk, the Afrikaans people. And the caption to the cartoon was The Great New Trek. Lothar chuckled and handed the new sheet back to his son. He knew very few Jews, and none who looked like Hoggenheimer. Most of them were as hard-working and ordinary as anyone else, and now were as poor and starving. If life were as simple as that. He shook his head. It is, Papa. All we have to do is get rid of the Jews. Oom Willem explained it. Lothar was about to reply when he realized that the smell of their food had attracted three of the camp's children, who were standing at a polite distance, watching each spoonful he raised to his mouth. The cartoon was no longer important. There was one older girl, about 12 years of age. She was blonde, her long braids bleached as silver and fine as the Kalahari grass in winter. She was so thin that her face seemed all bone and eyes, prominent cheekbones and a high, straight forehead. Her eyes were the light blue of the desert sky. Her dress was of old flour sacks sewn together, and her feet were bare. Clinging to her skirts were two smaller children, a boy with a shaven head and large ears. His skinny brown legs stuck out of his patched khaki shorts. The small girl had a runny nose, and she sucked her thumb as she clung to her elder sister's skirts with the other hand. Lothar looked away, but suddenly the food lost its flavour, and he chewed with difficulty. He saw that Hendrik was not looking at the children either. Manfred had not noticed them, and was still poring over the news sheet. "If we feed them, we'll have every kid in the camp on our backs," Lothar murmured, and he made a resolution never to eat in public again. "We've just got enough left for tonight," Hendrik agreed. "We cannot share it." Lothar raised the spoon to his mouth and then lowered it. He stared at the food on his tin plate for a moment and then beckoned the eldest girl. She came forward, shyly. "Take it," Lothar ordered gruffly. "Thank you, uncle," she whispered. "Danke, Oom." She whipped the plate under her skirt, hiding it from other eyes, and then dragged the two little ones away. They disappeared amongst the huts. The girl returned an hour later. The plate and spoon had been polished until they shone. "Does Oom have a shirt or anything that I can wash for him?" she asked. Lothar opened his pack and handed over his and Manfred's soiled clothing. She brought the laundry back at sunset, smelling faintly of carbolic soap and neatly folded. "Sorry, Oom, I didn't have a smoothing iron." "What is your name?" Manfred asked her suddenly. She glanced around at him, blushed scarlet, and looked at the ground. "Sarah," she whispered. Lothar buttoned the clean shirts. "Give me the 10 shillings, he ordered. "We'll have our throats cut if anybody knew that I have that much money," Hendrik grumbled. "You are wasting my time." "Time is the only thing we have plenty of," said Hendrik. Including the barman, there were only three men in the corner bar when Lothar pushed through the swing doors. "Quiet tonight," Lothar remarked as he ordered a beer, and the barman grunted. He was a nondescript little man with wispy grey hair and steel-framed spectacles. "Take a drink for yourself," Lothar offered, and the man's expression changed. "I'll take a gin, thank you." He poured from a special bottle that he produced from under the counter. They both knew that the colourless liquid was water, and the silver shilling would go directly into the barman's pocket. "Your health!" He leaned over the counter, prepared to be affable for a shilling and the possibility of another. They chatted idly, agreeing that times were hard and would get harder, that they needed rain, and that the government was to blame for it all. "How long have you been in town? I haven't seen you around," asked the barman.
"One day. One day too long," Lothar smiled.
"I didn't catch your name." And when Lothar told him, he showed genuine interest for the first time. "Hey," he called down the bar to his other customers. "Do you know who this is? It's Lothar de la Rey. Don't you remember the reward posters during the war? He is the one that broke the hearts of the Rouennecki."
Redneck was the derogatory term for the newly arrived Englishman, whose neck was inflamed by the sun.
"Man, he blew up the train at Gemsbokfontein."
So great was their approbation that one of them even bought him another beer, but prudently limited his largesse to Lothar alone.
"I'm looking for a job," Lothar told them when they had all become firm friends, and they all laughed. "I heard there was work out at the Hahani mine," Lothar persisted.
"I'd know if there was," the barman assured him. "The drivers from the mine come in here every week."
"Or would you give them a good word about me?" Lothar asked.
"I'll do better," said the barman.
"You come in Monday, and I'll set you up with Gerhard Fury, the chief driver. He's a good pal of mine. He'll know what's happening out there."
By the time Lothar left, he was established as a good fellow and a member of the inner clique of the corner bar. And when he returned 4 nights later, he was hailed by the barman.
"Fury is here," he told Lothar, "down at the end of the bar. I'll introduce you after I've served these others."
The barroom was half full this evening, and Lothar was able to study the driver. He was a powerful-looking man of middle age, with a big, slack gut from sitting hours each day behind the driving wheel. He was balding, but had grown the hair above his right ear and then plastered it across his pate with brilliantine. His manner was bluff and loud. He and his mates had the well-satisfied air of men who had just performed a difficult task. He didn't look like a man that you could threaten or frighten. But Lothar had not yet finally decided on what approach to take. The barman beckoned to him.
"Like you to meet a good friend."
They shook hands. The driver turned it into a contest, but Lothar had half expected that and shortened his grip, taking his fingers rather than his palm, so that Fury could not exert full force. They held each other's eyes until the driver winced and tried to pull his hand away. Lothar let him go.
"Buy you a drink."
Lothar felt easier now. The man was not as tough as he put out. And when the barman told them who Lothar was and related an exaggerated version of some of his exploits during the war, Fury's manner became almost fawning and obsequious.
"Look here, man."
He drew Lothar aside and lowered his voice. "Eric tells me you're looking for a job out at the Hahana mine.
Well, you can forget it, and that's straight. They haven't taken on any new men in a year or longer."
"Yes," Lothar nodded glumly. "Since I asked Eric about the job, I've learned the truth about the Hahani mine. It will be terrible for you all when it happens."
The driver looked uneasy. "What are you talking about, man? What truth is this?"
"Why, I thought you'd know." Lothar seemed amazed by his ignorance.
"They're going to close the mine in August, shut it down, pay everybody off." "Good Christ, no!"
There was fear in Fury's eyes.
"That's not true. It can't be true."
The man was a coward, gullible, easily impressed, and even more easily influenced. Lothar was grimly satisfied.
"I'm sorry, but it's the best to know the truth, isn't it?" he said. "Who told you this?"
Fury was terrified. He drove past the hobo camp down by the railway every week. He had seen the legion of the unemployed.
"I am walking out with one of the women who works for Abraham Abrahams."
He was the attorney who conducted all the business of the Hahani mine in Windhoek.
She saw the letters from Mrs. Courtney in Cape Town. There is no doubt. The mine is shutting down. They can't sell the diamonds. Nobody is buying diamonds, not even in London and New York.
Oh, my God, my God, whispered Fury. What are we going to do?
My wife isn't well, and we've got the six children. Sweet Jesus, my kids will starve.
It's all right for someone like you. I bet you've got a couple of hundred quid saved up. You'll be all right.
But Fury shook his head.
Well, if you haven't got anything saved, you had best put a few pounds aside before they lay you off in August.
How does a man do that? How do I save with a wife and six kids? Fury demanded hopelessly.
I'll tell you what. Lothar took his arm in a friendly, concerned grip. Let's get out of here. I'll buy a bottle of brandy. Let's go someplace where we can talk.
The sun was up by the time Lothar got back to the camp the following morning. They had emptied the brandy bottle while they talked the night away. The driver was intrigued and tempted by Lothar's proposition, but unsure and afraid. Lothar had to explain and convince him of every single point, particularly of his own safety.
Nobody will ever be able to point a finger at you. I give you my sacred word on it, said Lothar. You'll be protected even if something goes wrong.
And nothing will go wrong. Lothar had used all his powers of persuasion, and he was tired now as he trudged through the encampment and squatted down beside Hendrik.
Coffee? He asked, and belched the taste of old brandy into his mouth.
Finished. Hendrik shook his head.
Where is Manfred?
Hendrik pointed with his chin. Manfred was sitting under a thorn bush at the far end of the camp. The girl, Sarah, was beside him, their blonde heads almost touching as they pored over a sheet of newsprint. Manfred was writing on the margin of the page with a charcoal stick from the campfire.
Manny is teaching her to read and write, Hendrik explained.
Lothar grunted and rubbed his bloodshot eyes. His head ached from the brandy.
Well, he said, we've got our man.
Ah, Hendrik grinned. Then we will need the horses.
The private railway coach had once belonged to Cecil Rhodes and the De Beers Diamond Company. Santayne Courtney had purchased it for a fraction of the price that a new wagon would have cost her, a fact that gave her satisfaction. She was still a Frenchwoman and knew the value of a sou and a franc. She had brought out a young designer from Paris to redecorate the carriage in the Art Deco style, which was all the rage, and he had been worth every penny of his fee. She looked around the saloon, at the uncluttered lines of the furnishings, at the whimsical nude nymphs which supported the bronze light fittings, and the Aubrey Beardsley designs inlaid with exquisite workmanship into the lightwood panelling. And she remembered that the designer had struck her at first as being a homosexual, with his long, flowing locks, his darkly decadent eyes, and the features of a beautiful, bored and cynical fawn. Her first estimate had been far wide of the truth, as she had discovered to her delight on the circular bed which he had installed in the coach's main bedroom suite. She smiled at the memory and then checked the smile as she saw that Chasseur was watching her.
You know, Mater, I sometimes think I can see what you are thinking just by looking into your eyes.
He said these disconcerting things sometimes, and she was sure that he had grown another inch in the last week.
I certainly hope that you cannot, she said and shivered. It's cold in here.
The designer had incorporated, at enormous expense, a refrigeration machine which cooled the air in the saloon.
Do turn that thing off, Sherry.
She stood up from her desk and went out through the frosted glass doors, onto the balcony of the coach, and the hot desert air rushed at her and flattened her skirts across her narrow boyish hips. She lifted her face to the sun and let the wind ruffle her short curly hair. "What time is it?" she asked, with her eyes closed and face uplifted, and Chasser, who had followed her out, leaned against the balcony rail and consulted his wristwatch.
"We should be crossing the Orange River in the next 10 minutes, if the engine driver has kept us on schedule."
"I never feel as though we are home until I cross the Orange," she said, and she went to lean beside him and slipped her arm through his.